not just a saving grace, it's also a sign, it's a symptom of just how very badly things could go south if a Q-Max tanker or any tanker carrying liquefied natural gas broke up off the coast. And finally, could genetically modified mosquitoes be the cause of the Zika outbreak? Do you have any better ideas? The latest contagious virus freaking out the globe, particularly women worried about birth defects, may have been caused by the presence of genetically modified mosquitoes in Brazil. And this is indeed what has been going on. They have been modifying these mosquitoes. We haven't seen an outbreak of Zika like this in recent history. International health experts convening in Geneva to discuss the outbreak of possible cures for the Zika virus questions are being raised as to whether the genetically modified mosquitoes are to blame. That's it for today. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, February 1st, 2016. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks. Kate Kathleen Stevenson is a KBOOAM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. Here comes Locus Focus.
And I saw records made. Music literally written in wax.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival, running through February 8th. Friday, February 5th, will show American Epic. The film pieces together the extraordinary 1920s story of record companies leaving the big city to tour America's backroads and capture for the first time the raw musical expressions of rural cultures. These field recordings, initially aimed for the rural markets from which they came, democratized music and gave voice to the most marginalized demographics in the nation. That's February 5th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. What would an all-electric America look like, and why is it necessary not only to imagine such a reality, but to actually make it real? This morning we talk with S. David Freeman and Leah Y. Parks, co-authors of All Electric America. They'll explain how making the transition to an all-electric, all-renewable society is necessary, practical, financially viable, and achievable. David Freeman was one of the architects of the EPA under the Nixon administration and spent 30 years as a CEO of major public utilities in Texas, California, and New York. Co-author Leah Parks is an associate editor for ElectricityPollock.com and Electricity Daily. David and Leah, welcome to Lucas Focus.
Well, thank you for having us.
Okay, both jump in at the same time. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
I understand. Are you actually in Portland, Leah?
I am in Portland.
That's what I realized as I was looking at your phone number the other day. So I'm sorry we don't have you here live in the studio.
But, well, that's fine.
Yeah. So actually, I wanted to start by mentioning that when I was looking over your book to decide whether or not to do the interview, there are two chapters that jumped out at me, and that's why I decided I wanted to talk to you guys. And one was called The Hidden Truth About Natural Gas, and the other was Nuclear Energy Spare Us the Cure. And I thought, I was happy to see that your book is not one more apology for nuclear power and natural gas as carbon neutral sources of energy. So then I did a little Googling on you, David, and I came across this article in Atomic Insights by Rod Adams. And he says, I'm just going to read a couple sentences from this. It says, S. David Freeman, one of the most damaging energy policy makers of the 20th century, is trying to make a comeback. For those of you who are not energy geeks, S. David Freeman served on the predecessor to the FERC under President Kennedy and worked on energy policies for both Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. Jimmy Carter appointed him to lead the Tennessee Valley Authority, where he halted nuclear plant development in midstream and where he was an active opponent of breeder research development. And then it goes on to talk about how you've continued to try to get rid of nuclear power whenever possible. And in the rest of his article goes on to talk about how you're, oh, this is my other favorite part of it. He says S. David Freeman has written several books that remind me very much of the works of one of my other least favorite energy commentators, Amory Lovins. So I thought you might appreciate that one.
That was a nice compliment, I thought.
That's what I thought. So there's two things that I gleaned from this article. One is your work goes way, way back, which I could see as I was doing some research on you. And the other thing is you are no friend of the nuclear power industry. So I want to start by talking actually about this panacea that certain people, including James Hansen and Stuart Brand and Andrew Rifkin, who I've had on the show a number of times, who see nuclear power as a necessary bridge fuel to the future of alternative energy. And I want to start by talking about why you have some problems with that vision.
Well, it's not that I had problems. It's that nuclear power has been the greatest failure of anything in the energy field. When I was a young engineer, about 1949, I thought nuclear power was the wave of the future, too. That dream has been dreamt, and it turns out to be a nightmare. I mean, the plain truth of the matter is that there is no nuclear power plant being built in America by any utility that has to compete. There's one or two of them being built by monopoly utilities in Georgia, where the customers are subsidizing them. You know, I was fortunate enough to be with President Carter a few months ago, and we reminisced on the fact that we thought we'd never live to see the day when solar power is actually cheaper than nuclear power. So I don't know what these guys are talking about. It's been 50 years now. They don't know where to put the nuclear waste. It's piling up next to power plants. They can't compete in the marketplace, and they keep talking about a renaissance, but the plain truth of the matter is they've had 50 years, and it's not me or Ralph Nader or anybody else that shut down the nuclear power industry. It's the utility executives that are not buying it anymore. There was one CEO of a big utility in Chicago that said, nuclear power is not a religion. It's got to show itself in the marketplace. And, of course, to suggest that it is safe is to defy what's happened in Chernobyl, Fukushima, Three Mile Island. And the risk is greater than zero. The reason I know why, because they can't get insurance. I mean, the plain truth of the matter is that we can't even a plant that they're trying to build now takes 6, 8, 10 years. We haven't got that kind of time. You can put a solar panel on a roof in a few months or a few days, really. So I don't know what they're talking about. I mean, I've heard those speeches before. I heard them in the 1950s, in the 60s. They just didn't come true. And, but if somebody is religiously addicted to something, they can keep talking about it. They believe. But the facts are that nuclear power is the biggest failure that we've had, and they have. And if they think they can come up with something else that is completely clean and safe, God bless them. Let them do it. But they've had 50 years thus far, and they have nothing that anybody wants to buy.
Well, one of the things that has really astonished me and actually really frustrated me is a lot of, as an example, I was at a conference for the Society of Environmental Journalists about 6 or 7 years ago at Stanford, and there were a lot of people, both journalists and panelists that we had, and the woman who was the head of the environmental journalism department at Stanford, who were talking about how nuclear power was a necessary bridge fuel because there was no other way that we were going to be able to get to a carbon-free future because wind and solar, et cetera, and geothermal were not ready for full-scale marketing yet. And
well, let me stop you right there. Yeah. How can they say they're not ready when we're building thousands and thousands of megawatts of solar and wind, and in the red state of Texas, about one-third of the electricity comes from wind power. In the state of California, we're at 33% renewable, we're going to 50%. The technology is not only here, but over the life of the planet, it's lower in cost. And the people in the Northwest ought to understand this better than anyone. The hydropower you've got, it wasn't cheap when it was built, but the fuel is free. And a solar plant and a wind plant is the same thing. If you have free fuel, and you don't need many people to maintain it, and you don't, once you pay it off in 10 or 15 years, it's free electricity. And, the thing that breaks my heart is we've invented a better mousetrap, so to speak, and we just don't seem to have the willpower or the brain power to deploy it for everything that's new.
What I find interesting actually is like it seems like coal now is on everybody's list of coal is over. And coal is the market seems to be really crashing, and they're very except for the coal industry itself and maybe the states of Kentucky and West Virginia and Wyoming, there's very little support for coal anywhere. But still, and oil is seen as, maybe over, except that we keep producing it in North Dakota. But natural gas and nuclear energy seem to have really strong proponents, including in the White House. I mean, there's this...
Yeah, well, let Leah tell you about natural gas.
Okay. Well, actually, I want to just finish up with the nuclear conundrum, and then I want to get into natural gas, and then we'll talk about what can be done and what should be done. But my impression, especially when I was at this conference, this was about 7 years ago, I guess, and maybe there wasn't quite as much online then in the ways of wind and solar as there is now. But I found that people there, including the woman who was the head of the environmental journalism department there, knew very little about the history of nuclear power and how the issues with waste. And I mentioned Hanford to her, and she had Hanford confused with Three Mile Island. So I thought there seems to be not a lot of knowledge of the history of the nuclear industry and how damaging it's been.
I think that's part of the problem. There are a lot of young people that didn't live through the agonies of nuclear power. If you've been a utility executive like I have been with nuclear power plants on your system, you know how bad they are. I mean, I used to dread looking at the paper in the morning for fear that there was a story about something had gone wrong and my people hadn't told me about it yet. I mean, with my own vote, I shut down 8 nuclear power plants under construction because they just cost too damn much to finish, and it wasn't worth it, in addition to the safety problems and the fact that we don't know what to do with the waste. Nobody wants them. We shut down a power plant in Southern California two years ago, and the local people now want the waste removed. There's no place to take it. It's a radioactive mess that's going to be with us. It's a forever problem. if you've got something that you're creating that is radioactive and you don't know what to do with it, there's only one cure, and that's birth control. Making it.
Well, I want to talk about natural gas now. I want listeners to know that if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with S. David Freeman and Leah Y. Parks, who are authors of All Electric America. And we're talking about how it is not only possible, but necessary to make a very quick switch from fossil fuels and nuclear to renewable energy, in particular solar and wind and geothermal. Leah, let's talk about natural gas before we get into the possible and wonderful future of all renewables. Why, in your chapter, why do you have the chapter where you say the hidden truth about natural gas? What is its hidden truth?
Well, the hidden truth is that natural gas is absolutely not a bridge fuel, and that it's not cleaner than coal. That it, although if you burn natural gas, perhaps there's less particulate matter, as far as greenhouse gases, we are producing methane and carbon dioxide. And we actually burn twice as much natural gas than we do coal. And that's because of our heating and our industrial processes. So we're producing almost as much carbon dioxide from our natural gas use than we are from our coal use. So if we were to switch to natural gas from coal to natural gas, we'd make absolutely no impact on how much greenhouse gases we have. And then, of course, there's leakage. And leakage is another huge problem. We don't know how much we're leaking. We could be leaking somewhere between, estimates are 1.5% of the natural gas we use is leaking to 10% or 17%. And there's huge debates on that. But the fundamental truth is that even if we leak 1% or 1.5%, well, we are still then, because of the methane leakage, producing as much greenhouse gas as we are from coal. Well, so it's and people have done research on comparing it, and the impact, the cooling impact, is almost nothing. So it's really too little too late, and it's not a bridge fuel at all.
Well, actually, I think the greatest indications about leakage is going on right now in Southern California with the Porter Ranch methane leak. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that as far as, I mean, that seems like that's the worst case scenario, but that's one of the dangers of natural gas.
Yeah,
yes,
that's exactly
true. That is an 800-pound canary in the coal mine, so to speak. I don't know, that is telling us what is happening throughout the natural gas system, but it is so gigantic. And the thing that is so aggravating is that other than you and maybe the people in Southern California, it's not getting any attention throughout the country because we can't see it. You know, we're not using our brains on this subject at all, and you're right about the lack of knowledge. But that leak has gone on for months. They don't know how to stop it. It is gigantic, and it's just symptomatic of what's happening at every fracking well and in every old pipeline that's 30, 40 years old. And Mother Nature, it doesn't know the difference between coal and natural gas because they're just at least about, as Leah pointed out, they're about equal in total greenhouse gases. So I must say that it's just aggravating about the ignorance that we have among the people that claim that they're concerned about climate. But if they don't do anything about it, aren't they denying just as much as the dumb deniers?
Yeah, it's interesting because it seems like a lot of it has to do with financial interests. And there's a big incentive on the part of a lot of utilities who are very heavily invested in natural gas and the natural gas industry to keep promoting it in the same way that there's incentives, I guess, for the nuclear industry to promote themselves. Why do you think there's so many politicians who are along the same lines as President Obama who see natural gas? I mean, well, who, I guess Obama is now making some shifts in terms of trying to do some regulation and some making the fracking industry at least acknowledge what or disclose what kinds of chemicals they're using. But there seems to have been a great pass for years and years. Let's just let this fracking go. Let's just, you know, produce as much natural gas as we can. What do you think is the incentive that keeps people moving in that direction?
Leah, go ahead.
Well, I'll say something, but I think Dave should say something too, because he's probably, he talked to me a lot about it. And, but I think that they have money, and they have a position already in the energy industry, and they don't want to lose it. It's, you know, the fossil fuel industry is the buggy whip on steroids. I mean, this is a dying industry. We will transition out of it, but they don't want to lose what they've got. And I think they've got a good story that they're cleaner than coal. And it just feels, I think, easier to people, or somehow convenient. And there's a lot of money. I mean, it isn't easier, because fracking takes a lot of work and resources to do, just like in putting any other energy source in. But I think that's a big part of it. And they've got money to lobby and money to convince the politicians that they're clean. They go on every night talking about how they're clean on the news, and I get advertisements on Twitter about how they're clean. So they're convincing people.
Well, I like to see a campaign like the Sierra Club's Clean Coal campaign a few years ago about what clean coal was, and it's, of course, doesn't exist. It's a myth. It seems like maybe it's time for one of the environmental groups that has a good advertising budget, like Sierra Club, to take on the natural gas industry. Do you think that's a possibility?
I think you'll find that if you look deeply enough, that the gas industry contributed money in years past to the Sierra Club. I mean, there is no environmental movement today like there was in the 70s. These big box environmental organizations have got big budgets, and people are making decent salaries, and their main objective is fundraising. They are not out there screaming to high heaven about what's going on, and there's an attempt on their part to want to have access to the White House and access, and so they don't, in my view, they don't get out there and shout the truth. And there's a lot of ignorance about natural gas. Natural gas industry does a lot of advertising, and there's a lot of buses all over town that talk about clean natural gas. We are among the few people that are trying to tell the truth about natural gas, and we appreciate this opportunity to talk to your listeners, because that voice isn't heard much. So we got a combination of influence, ignorance, and it's just inconvenient to take on both the coal industry and the natural gas industry. And I think it's a lack of political courage on the part of the Obama administration, quite frankly.
Well, actually, there are, and let me, a lower tier in terms of influence and money, number of environmental groups that have really taken on natural gas and fracking. One that comes to mind is Food and Water Watch, and they've been actually sending out emails about the Porter Ranch gas leak and comparing it to the BP oil spill in 2010. And there are actually quite a few environmental groups who are very opposed to fracking and very opposed to expanding natural gas, and who are your allies as far as really calling for studies about the amount of methane leakage. And I think because of that, the EPA is actually now considering doing those studies. So it's just that I think that the really visible environmental groups, a handful of them, like the Natural Resources Defense Council.
I think you're right about grassroots environmental groups. I'm speaking to the big organizations in Washington, D.C.
Right, I agree with you. The Sierra Club's a funny group, because I think that I could see them getting close to starting to take on natural gas the way they, because they've taken on oil. They've been very strong leadership in fighting all the efforts to build fossil fuel storage facilities here in the Pacific Northwest. And
yeah,
they've been working in a... Hello?
I'd like to say just a word about this LNG issue, which I heard you talk about just before we came on. It is insane, and I emphasize the word insane, to be building new LNG facilities in the year 2016. Don't they realize that in order to have LNG, you have to take the natural gas, and you lose some of it when you freeze it, and then you lose some more when you unfreeze it. So all those losses make LNG worse than coal. And the idea that we would build some terminals that stuff needs to be phased out 3% a year, or we all cook. I mean, can't the Obama administration, doesn't it have the authority under international law to stop an LNG project from taking place?
I think that they're working here, we're working here on the state level to get the Obama administration to do that. And I think you'd be happy to know that there's a very broad coalition of large and small environmental groups, including a number of national groups who are opposing the LNG plants that are proposed down in southern Oregon and on the Columbia River. So I think that there's a rising consciousness about that.
Yeah, I hope they're aware that from a greenhouse gas point of view, it's much worse than even natural gas because of the losses involved in freezing it and unfreezing it.
Actually, I'd like to move now to some positive things and talk about why you believe that an all-electric future is in the cards for America and why the technology is at hand and available and becoming more and more affordable.
Well, in the Pacific Northwest, you have heat pumps. In the Tennessee Valley, we've had heat pumps for years. You can heat a home with electricity. That's not a new invention. We were talking about the all-electric home back in the 30s and the 40s. My little hometown of Chattanooga, Tennessee, we burned coal in the furnaces before TVA came with the hydropower, and we cleaned the city up. The same thing in the Northwest. So we know how to use electricity to heat up, to do heating. We now have electric cars. We know, and guess what? The railroads in every country but America are run by electricity. But what the problem that we have is that the Obama administration and most of the environmentalists are simply focusing on the current market for electricity and trying to get more and more renewables. But that's just about 35% of the total energy market. And if we're going to meet what the family doctor, the climatologist, says we must do in the next 35 years, we've got to move toward an all-electric America 3% a year, and we can do it. And the interesting thing is that we will have lower costs because once the solar, wind, and storage investments are made, you've got virtually free electricity. It won't be completely free, but it's going to be very low in cost, and I think that it's breaking my heart, really, to see this country squabbling over something that we can do, and actually life will be much the same as it is, but if we don't do it, we don't know what kind of life we're going to have. And the whole debate about climate is assumed that it's a big sacrifice. And it's going to hurt the economy when the truth is just the opposite. We'll have lower energy costs, the environment will be cleaner, and we'll create literally millions of jobs in building this all-electric America.
Well, one of the concerns that was raised, and actually probably some people still raise it, about solar and wind is that because they don't, the sun doesn't shine all the time and the wind doesn't blow all the time, you need to have some way to store the electricity that's generated during the times of sunshine and wind blowing. And storage batteries until recently were not that great, and so there was a limited amount of storage.
Yeah, but that's where ignorance is our problem. Batteries are not the only way that we store electricity. I have run utility systems. There are pump storage plants that exist today that store electricity. You run the water, you pump it up at night, and you use it when you need it in the afternoon. There is compressed air. There are new inventions in batteries. I mean, the plain truth of the matter is if you quadrupled the price of storage, that storage, solar, and wind would still be cheaper than nuclear. I mean, we have not yet decided that the climate issue is something that we must respond to.
Actually, I heard Leo.
We haven't got there. We still are talking about it's going to cost too much. Well, it ain't going to cost too much. But the plain truth of the matter is that we haven't gotten across to America that we have the technology, that it is better. And that's what our book is all about. And we hope that we will get across to people and we have a kind of a grassroots understanding, and then the politicians and the electric power industry will follow. So Our biggest problem is that the people that sell electricity are not entrepreneurs. They're regulated utilities that want to do tomorrow what they did yesterday, and we've got to change the signals that we send them. And indeed, that's beginning to happen.
So, Lee and I
are optimistic. We think that we're on the verge of what people might call a revolution, but it's an evolution. The only issue is it going to happen in 100 years and we cook, or can it happen in 35 years and we be able to control these greenhouse gases soon enough that the ice doesn't melt on Greenland and the tundra doesn't go away and all that methane under it in Siberia doesn't kill us. We're in a race against time, and hopefully we're going to win.
Okay, Leah, it sounds like you had something you wanted to say.
Well, I agree with Dave. This is actually a very exciting time, and I think if we could harness the excitement of this rather than always than dwelling on climate change and the worries of climate change and really start thinking about what's possible for the future, that would probably really help this move along. Because if once we start this, we're going to see the most exciting energy transformation that we've seen in over 100 years. And it's going to be fundamentally different the way it's different in how we have smartphones in our hands. And everybody can have solar panels. We'll be managing our own energy differently. We'll have microgrids. We'll have more grid stability or security because of it. And the way there will be flows of electrons to and from our homes, multidirectional flows of electrons, this is as exciting and as transformational as our digital transformation we are having now. And electricity has been the backbone of our digital transformation. And now our electricity industry, which is an old kind of dinosaur of an industry, is going to really come back to life. And it's going to be exciting. Electric cars are exciting too. My husband and I got a Volt, and the pleasure of plugging our car in is and not having to go to the gas station is phenomenal. And the fun and the excitement of driving the electric car. I drove in a Tesla, and Mark Jacobson, I drove in his Tesla, and professor of Stanford. And I knew that was the future. I mean, this car was amazing. The acceleration, the smoothness, the quietness of this. I mean, this is just, I was never a car aficionado. And I just thought, wow. Look at this. I felt like the people must have felt the last turn of the century when they saw electricity for the first time. And I think that we can have young people and the American people in general just get excited about this transformation.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Leah Y. Parks and S. David Friedman, who are co-authors of All Electric America, and we're talking about how the United States needs to transform itself from fossil fuels to an all-electric economy and energy source that's driven by renewable energy. One of the things that you mentioned about having electric heat, which of course has been around for a long time, but I don't know anybody right now who has electric heat who's particularly happy with it. I mean, it's a real different feeling to... I'm actually not that crazy about forced air heat either, which is what my house has. But we also have a radiant heater, and it's a gas radiant heater, so of course it's a methane issue. But there's that certain kind of warmth comfort that you get from radiant heat. Is there a way to make an electric radiant heater that would be as satisfying as a wood-burning or gas-burning radiant heater?
I honestly don't know, but you put your finger on what I think is something we have to overcome. Al Gore used the right word when he said an inconvenient truth. You know, if in order to save civilization, we have to be heated by electricity rather than some fuzzy feeling. If we can't handle that, we're just the latest version of the dinosaur. And I repeat, until the people in this country decide that this is something that we've got to do for survival. I mean, I fought in World War II. This climate issue, the way people describe it correctly, is a greater threat than World War II. I mean, nobody was asking any questions about what to do. The President of the United States picked up the phone and told Detroit, stop making automobiles and start making tanks and airplanes, and they did. I mean, I was a high school kid. We were doing recycling we were doing things, and some of them were a little bit inconvenient. I'm not saying that this is going to be a joyride. I am saying that we have the technology. It can get the job done. The price of energy is going to be cheaper. There may be an adjustment or two, but if all it takes to save civilization is to be heated by electricity and stay warm and have to have a blanket around you rather than not, I would say that we've got to decide that we got to do that.
I mean, there's other areas. Leah was talking about the joys of electric cars. I mean, in my mind, I'm not a big car fan myself, and I certainly don't like the internal combustion engine. And the idea of being able to get around in a vehicle that did not pollute and did not make noise would be also nice if it didn't kill people. You know, you didn't have accidents, but that's another story. That there's a great attraction to that. And I wonder what other ways that you see that promoting renewables, particularly solar and wind, as a sources of energy would really enhance the way that we live now.
Well, I've been in the electric power business most of my life, and customers are interested in only really two things. One, the price they have to pay and the reliability. So this electric system made of solar and wind can be pretty stable in price, and with storage reliable, customers are going to be probably more satisfied than they are today. And those are the essentials. And frankly, some of this new technology is going to be very exciting in the but I make my fundamental point. Even you have not decided that this is something you got to do because you're asking questions about convenience. If we take this the way we took a war or the way we decided to go to the moon, we didn't ask questions about whether it's convenient or how much it's going to cost. It's something that we felt like that we were going to, by gosh, do. And we haven't, I think the 20-somethings feel that way. This is their issue. And I think if we will just give the younger generation the knowledge about what can be done, it might take a little while, but they'll get it done.
I think what we're going to experience may be a little bit like personal computers in 1985 and when we first started getting our internet connections in 1990. If anybody of any of your listeners remembers dialing up and the time it took to connect to the internet, and also how our personal computers, how we had to use DOS programs or whatever. You know, it's the beginning of the technology isn't all going to be what it's going to be in 10 years or 15 years from now. You know, we have the personal computer version. We don't have the smartphone version yet of the electrical infrastructure. You know, what we see today and what's available to us today, once we start implementing it, it'll be different in 10 years. And they've already gone very far with heat pumps. You know, my parents just got a heat pump, and actually, they're finding more comfortable than gas.
Actually, I want to talk about heat pumps. That was one of the questions I had because it sounded very intriguing to me, but I didn't feel I got a lot of clarity in your book about exactly how they work. So let's talk about what a heat pump is and how it works and why you think it's the wave of the future.
Well, a heat pump is basically just like your refrigerator, and it's like your air conditioner, and the heat pump can either run so that it produces heat, or it can run so it makes it air conditions your home. So it can either run in reverse, in whichever way you can consider reverse. So it extracts heat from the outside air, or from the ground, or from a water source, and then it brings it into your home, and you can use forced heat to you can, is it?
Forced air.
Forced heat. Forced air. You can use forced air to blow it, or you can send it through coils, or there are different methods of sending it through your home. And it's very widely used throughout the world. And it is used in, a lot in the South, in southern states. Tennessee Valley Authority, Dave, I think, had programs there when he was there to use them.
Still going on.
Is that clear? Or
yeah. Well, how much does it cost? Because that was the other thing. It seemed it can be a very costly, the upfront expenses of putting a heat pump in your house. Or it's a lot more expensive than putting a gas furnace in, isn't it?
Well, my parents just got a unit for $12,000 here in Portland. They actually went online to find a contractor. And to the Energy Trust of Oregon, the Energy Trust of Oregon has recommended contractors, and they found somebody, and their unit was $12,000. It produces air conditioning and it produces heating, and they got 0% interest financing. And financing is key, because they didn't have $12,000 to plunk down, and the unit they ended up getting was a unit that had financing. I actually wanted them to get the Mitsubishi model, the brand new Mitsubishi model. They got a very high efficiency one, but that one, it didn't have financing. So they chose the one with financing.
So what's the difference between the high efficiency?
It's about the same. It just
works better.
Works better. Yeah. I mean, how much energy it uses to extract the heat and produce.
So the energy is the heat pumps are powered by electricity. Is that?
Yes.
Theoretically, when Portland General Electric switches totally to wind and solar, then the heat pump will be run on totally renewable energy.
Exactly.
Correct.
Okay. So yeah, you're saying the thing about the financing. So that's the other issue.
It's
big for people.
It was really about the same price as getting a brand new air conditioner and brand new furnace. Maybe a bit more, but their energy costs will actually be lower. So over time, it'll pay for itself. And if they had gotten a ground source heat pump, which they didn't get because there was no financing for ground source heat pumps, it would have even been better. Those are even more efficient.
And those are also more expensive, aren't they, the ground source
ones?
Yeah,
they're more expensive. They are.
But let's really need financing. Let's be careful about the word expensive. We've got to let people understand that they need to evaluate things on the cost per year. You make investments. And if you invest more, but the annual costs are going to be much lower, you're actually saving money. It's not more expensive. It's more cost effective. And that means that we need the utilities, instead of financing power plants. In our book, we're suggesting that they ought to be financing things like heat pumps. And maybe we need if we want to get really serious about this, there is plenty of money in this country, and there's plenty of borrowing that goes on. These would be great investments. There could be a green bank that will make loans for these, for this conversion to an all-electric economy, and low-cost loans. And if you invest then on the basis of the annual cost over the life of the product, what we're talking about is inherently cheaper. And so the language needs to reflect the facts in order to educate people. And unfortunately, most people just look at first cost. If they could be financed and they don't have to put enough. I had a program at the Tennessee Valley back in the 70s where we financed efficiency. And I got a tremendous sign up for it. And the thing about it is 99 people out of 100 will agree if you have an energy doctor that comes to their house, prescribes what needs to be done to make it all electric, the utility finances it, and then they pay back over the life of the product out of their savings. That system has worked, can work, needs to be implemented. We just haven't decided that this is something that we've got to do.
Actually, we're sort of out of time. There's one other thing I really just want to touch on really briefly that I thought was very appealing in your book, is the whole idea that the sources of energy you're looking at could also really take advantage of distributed power, as opposed to having like these large grids and everything being electricity being sent from very far away. In like about 30 seconds, can we just talk about distributed power and why this would be such a powerful way?
Yeah, Leo, go ahead.
Well, distributed power will allow smaller businesses to and people to actually own some of their own power and manage some of it. And if the electricity and the grid goes down, you'll be able to continue to have power in your home. And so it'll be a whole new way of living. That's why I say it's kind of like having the smartphone, where we have a connection to the entire world in our hand. Well, we'll have our smartphone, and it will connect us to our energy use. And if there's a power outage, we'll have a battery in our home that will seamlessly, you know, allow us to still have our refrigerator working and some of our basic needs, and depending how big our unit is, most of our needs are all.
Okay.
And so that's exciting.
And it is exciting to talk to you guys. I'm sorry we're out of time, but this has been really interesting and a lot to think about. We've been talking this morning with S. David Freeman and Leah J. Y. Parks, co-authors of All Electric America, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. I want to thank you guys very much for joining me. And if you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with environmental ethicist Kathleen D. Moore, author of The Great Tide Rising. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to watch some music by Abby Lincoln. Thanks for listening.
And thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. And then at 11:30 on Madness Radio, Will Hall speaks with Laura Delano about her journey to become medication-free and what happens when medications for emotional problems become worse than the problems themselves. Thanks, KBOO members, for supporting your community radio station. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy, a talk by author Derek Cressman on Friday, February 2nd, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Cressman will discuss how courts have foiled attempts to limit campaign spending, what a constitutional amendment limiting paid speech could say, and much more.